sucks. Reading, writing, and speaking have the power to cast spells, make dreams come true, and disperse pain. It fills the atmosphere in a different way than objects or images. Each of these writers have inspired me in different ways, and I'm grateful to know them. Thank you, Hilton, Kirsty, and CA. Thank you to Karma for hosting us. To Brendan, Sanisha, Sarah, Connor, and Matt at Karma Books. And thank you to Jason and Katuda. Showing with a friend is joy. Thanks.
Thank you so much. I'm so proud to be here to support Tony, his wonderful show with his great artists, and I love environments more than anything. That's what you've done here, and it takes a lot of work and knowledge and subtlety and editing to make environments this beautiful. So I congratulate everyone and in the gallery for allowing it to be. It's a very rare thing. I thought, since we were in the East Village, that I would read about a woman I knew a long time ago, who's passed away now, but who was a great friend to me. Her name was Valda Grinfels Zaiga, and she was a Latvian woman who was much admired among a certain generation of artists. And she had the sort of, the more I think about it and the more I see, she was very sort of maverick in her tastes and beliefs. I could not, even though these artists imagined her in lots of paintings and drawings, she just was not an artist's wife by any stretch of the imagination, and, which means, you know, cataloging their shit. And I really loved her for that. And so I thought we would remember her and Nights That Save the Robots, not too far away. My partner, who's much younger than me, has recently asked me what it was like at Save the Robots and the World, and I told him to go away. And recently we were watching a program on dementia, and I told him to get ready. So it's okay. I got a lot of sympathy from him for that. Anyway, her name was Valda. I don't use her name here. I use the nickname that I called her, which was Mrs. Vreeland, after Diana Vreeland. In 2007, someone did die. She was one of my first eyes and integral to all the years I've described. I've waited until now to talk about her because that's the way she would have wanted it. She was a great believer in traditional story structure and would say, apropos her appearance here, what readers crave most, what fills them up, is the story of love and how it ends. As a spoken word critic, one of the very best, she knew what was real when she read it because she trusted her gut. Indeed, she had a great interest in her gut. She was always thin, but she ate more food than any human I have ever known. Even after she got sick, she longed for me to describe a dinner party I had attended. She licked her lips. I'm always hungry, she said. She came to the first reading I ever gave at my college, and while I read, she sat in the front row with her then boyfriend eating a hoagie. After the reading, she said that I needed more stuff behind me while I read to lively things up. Lights, a video, but I'm getting ahead of my story. She was our first home. No, She was our tree, and we hung in her young branches, our bodies swaying like flags in a permanent sweet chill. Then a little sunshine through the branches, some bird sounds, and maybe Jesus floating beyond the birds. No, she was a white girl, whatever that means. No, she was colored because she preferred colored men to most white people. No, she was words, and they always came up short against her presence. And if you were a poet whose vocation it is to take the words out from in between other words and relish white space, then you would be more suited to the task of relaying who she was, as well as Stephen seemed to do when he wrote in 1947, 12 years before she was born and 60 years before she died, in his poem, So-and-So Reclining on Her Couch, quote, "She floats in air at the level of the eye, completely anonymous, born as she was at 21, without lineage or language only, the curving of her hip as motionless gesture, eyes dripping blue, so much to learn," unquote. What can I tell you about her that might not sound trite by comparison? Well, there are mundane details that don't diminish her. She loved proper storytelling, the details and hidden meanings and facts and all. But let me just say that the details, how we met, how she and SL met, how she died, how SL and I died, diminish me, or rather the whole storytelling enterprise does. Words limit things. That's what I told her once. We were sitting in her little house near a pond on Long Island. She had said goodbye to Manhattan years before, but she was made for New York. She was beautiful and made no sense and made perfect sense, just like Greenwich Village or the Bronx. We were sitting in her little house and she was so sick. Jesus, help her. And I was saying how much I loved her without telling her that, because that's how we talked, by not talking. We didn't want speech to limit us. Instead, we did things like making a chicken, or the first time we had SL come over to her place in New York and to accommodate his vegetarianism, a gratin dauphinoise. Sitting in her house, I could not say how much I loved her, even though time and her body were saying I wouldn't have many more opportunities to do so, but we never talked much, and as SL said during that time, why start now? SL understood intuitively, which is the best way to understand anything, my thoughts on that particular subject. If I said I loved her, it would limit her to my love, just as a tree once described becomes just a tree or your tree. I always wanted others to know her and cherish their perspective of her. That would mean there was more of her in the world. How marvelous. And other men, aside from SL and myself, who felt as one of my boyfriends felt when he said after meeting her, "Whatever that girl has, someone should bottle it." Let me just say one reason I can talk about this at all is because of SL and Mrs. Vreeland, as I called her. They wanted my eye more than most other things, and what is writing but an eye insisting on its point of view? Fuck them for making me do it. Fuck them and love them for making me do it. Let me just say, I never wanted my love or language to limit her and relegate her vibrancy, but that's what time and illness did anyway. Confine her body to a wheelchair, such sadness I can't even tell you. Imagine Holly Golightly or Sally Bowles or Maxine Falk or Vera Cicero in the 1984 film The Cotton Club and Ferns not walking down the street or swimming with their boys in the sea, sick and feeling useless to themselves after all those years of creating such lasting, vibrant images in someone else's mind, artists and writers for the most part, images that might include this one, a city girl walking somewhere, sometimes with a purse in hand, her fur wrap pulled tightly around her, a little snow falling, the memory of a lover's kiss somewhere on her person. So many opportunities. Sometimes life offered a quick, synthetic fix that felt like a million roses smothering them, but then nothing, and that remarkable white girl struck down by some uncontrollable internal malady. And tell me, SL, or someone, what's left of that body and its memories? the beautiful things artists who admired her made of her. Wallace Stevens got it right when he said, in so-and-so reclining on her couch, that his white girl was, quote, actually this mechanism, this apparition, suppose we call her projection A, unquote. I can't write one complete sentence about her because she was her own complete sentence, and her sentence about herself was better than anyone else's because she uttered it sort of without thinking while thinking too much. I can't tell you how unusual that is in a world where, nowadays, no one leaves the house without some kind of script. Still, her brilliance was in part contingent on knowing how the New York City script, a story of youth and ambition and race and blood and money, works and needs to work in order to be a story, and therefore of value to other people. The human mind cleaves to details and what happened next, so it can imagine what happened next. And I haven't even told you enough of the story, so you can imagine who she was and take it from there. She was a white girl who, while growing up in New Jersey, read Kurt Vonnegut and listened to punk music and jazz. In high school, she sported a beret a la Ricky Lee Jones. She was a newspaper freak, and as a young woman, wrote letters in support of Rajneesh Param, despite the facts. She wanted to protect the faithful from the faithless. She regarded SL's vegetarianism as a kind of faith, and she admired it, but how could she give up her belief in bacon? Her attraction to men who had language was profound. Sometimes she'd visit me at the weekly newspaper I worked at back in the day, because she was also drawn to a pasty gay journalist who spread his body anywhere there was available space. She called him the answer grape because he looked like a grape and he had all the answers. She was the daughter of Europeans, immigrants who'd survived the World War to find something like stability in North America, and their survivalist instincts may have contributed to her own, which included being very protective of her son. When she was up to no good, you could see it on her face. So, to some extent, she was always an innocent, albeit one who thought, you could consider doing the right thing, but you could consider doing the wrong thing, too. For as long as I knew her, she walked a moral balance beam in high heels without chalking up her hands. She was as interested in sometimes falling off that beam on a friend's bad side as she was on their good. The first time I saw her, she was a waitress in a gay bar, were we even 21 years old. She was the lovely, ebullient, practical-minded girl artists always love having around to remind them that the world exists and Con Edison would like to hear from you, all while painting her portrait. She worked in that bar in 1980 or 1981, and she was close to Jean-Michel Basquiat, who died in 1988. The summer, she went to Europe with her first husband, a beautiful Berber boxer who was so kind to me. And when she got back from Europe, we drove out to Brooklyn in her little car to visit Jean's grave, just me and her. SL didn't even know about that pilgrimage until after 2007. And at Jean-Michel's grave in that Brooklyn cemetery, she kept saying, poor baby, poor baby, as she towed the dead leaves away from his grave's mouth. Standing there, looking down at her looking down, I remember that Jean-Michel was indeed a baby when I met him. He was 17 and I was 16. We were introduced by a fat and funny white girl who had an apartment in Brooklyn Heights. But is it an introduction if one of the two people won't say hello and just stared? Because that's what Jean-Michel did when he met me. We stood in that girl's attic room in Brooklyn Heights. Jean-Michel had a mohawk. I had never seen a black man with hair like that, and he was wearing a green mechanics jumper. He was so vibrant and hungry, predatory might be the word. He wanted to get somewhere, and he kept staring at me, and it wasn't until years later that I heard he liked black boys as much as he liked white girls. So I wonder what it was like for him when I showed up with Mrs. Reland. I called her Mrs. Reland from the first because she was stylish, and everything she wore was unfussy and the opposite of fashion. And what did the first Mrs. Reland say about style? It helps you get down the stairs. My Mrs. Reland got down the stairs all right, but sometimes she tripped or stumbled, which is a form of being graceful too, since what is grace but the desire to forget one's own body and share it with others? She did both. I saw it all at one of Jean-Michel's first big exhibitions. He was part of a group show called New York New Wave. And oh my God, I just looked it up. The show took place at PS1 in 1981. Like an Adrian Kennedy heroine, I would give anything just now if I could talk to Jesus about that night and just once. I would tell him what I remember about it. Were we even 21? Yes, we were, just. And I don't think I even put the Jean who wouldn't take my hand in Mrs. Reland's presence together with the artist whose work I saw in a show I had admired tremendously some time before. The Times Square show, a show that combined the refined and the dissolute. How perfect was that, since New York was a disaster area then, so why couldn't an exhibition be a disaster area too? I don't think I took much notice of Jean-Michel's paintings at PS1. I don't think I took much notice of Jean-Michel's paintings at PS1, though, since what was interesting to me that night was watching and not watching as the artist sometimes watched me and looked at Mrs. Reland. I give anything to talk to Jesus about it just once, because it was one of those moments when life was changing me, and she was life, a skinny white girl talking to an existentially freaked black man, and already I was in love with Mrs. Reland's bravery. How many white girls do you know, Jesus, who didn't grow up around colored people, and who step outside of what life is supposed to look like for them, was just to say white, and put on a party dress to look pretty for, and try to please a black man who almost never has any power at all. Those impulses are rarer than you think. I seem to remember the dress, if not the material, then the shape she wore that evening at PS1. The skirt was reinforced with a little not much crinoline. The artist and his muse talked to one another as lovers do. He was living with another woman by then, but I'm not sure if that was a heartbreak for Mrs. Reland, because other people interested her as well. Besides, she liked her heart's desires being a secret, a story only she could tell when she wanted to tell it. She was so intelligent about men and had realized at an early age that despite the bluster, they were essentially passive creatures. You could get one if you wanted one, she said, no problem. She was Fitzgerald's Jordan Baker, in that she was aware that it took two to have an accident. But she was herself when she said to me once as I tried to learn how to drive a car and was too frightened of other people, they have brakes too. As Mrs. Reland and Jean talked to each other in a conspiratorial way at that opening, I became what I would always be later in her and SL's presence, a kid loving the smell of their adhesion. How did people talk the way as Jean-Michel was talking to Mrs. Reland now, in the utter privacy of their souls, and yet in public for all the world to see. To talk to myself, even, I had to turn off the lights, as in a cinema. Thank you.
Thank you, Tony, for asking me to speak here. It's a real honor. And I've decided to read something that's something I've been talking to Tony about over the last few months. It's a very new piece of writing the beginning of a new kind of bigger project that I'm working on, so it's very raw. It's a kind of a prelude. So this is the first outing of it. So yeah, it's a bit of a taster. I set myself the task to write a portrait of the city. An impossible task, perhaps, and I don't know why now, except that the house I moved to recently seemed somehow to suggest it. When I moved to this house on the banks of the Landwehr Canal, I thought of living on the water as a way to find a current. To write about the place I live could be a way to counteract the drift. But this subject, the city, refuses to be neatly contained or firmly grasped. This writing has become sprawling and unruly, and so begins to resemble the city itself. Berlin spread out wide without any discernible banks. One big, lonely city. I don't think I believe in destiny, but I did notice how insistently the view from my kitchen window began presenting itself to me, and at the same time as a series of unrelated accidents, broken pipes, a leaking roof, some badly connected appliances, brought on repeated occurrences of water damage in the apartment we moved into. Feng Shui says this is a sign of grief. The water element breaks its bank and the house itself is crying. The view outside my window, meanwhile, was hypnotizing me. The first ever photographic image taken by Joseph Niepce in 1826 or 27 was the view outside the window of his studio in Burgundy. It shows a shadowy arrangement of soft grey planes and solids, the angle of a roof. 10 years later, the first photograph of a human being by Louis Daguerre was of the view outside his window, a sweeping vista of Boulevard du Temple in Paris. With an exposure time of several hours, the movements of people or horses and carriages on this busy city street did not register at all. Only one man was visible, standing with one leg raised, apparently having his shoes shined, for hours on end, static within that city's moving current. I read about these photographs in a book called Autumn by Karl Ove Knausgård. In it, he takes the stuff around him and describes it task-like in a series of short texts he says he's writing for his unborn daughter. This task-like kind of writing appeals, another way to counteract the drift, perhaps, particularly if the things you're writing about are themselves the stuff of drift, flotsam of daily life washed up on the shores of consciousness. It reminds me of Georges Perec's taxonomical text called The Objects That Are On My Work Table, one of my favorite pieces of writing, which sees Perec shifting focus from thought to thing as a way to write about work itself in, as he puts it, an attempt to grasp something pertaining to my experience, not at the level of its remote reflections, but at the very point where it emerges. It's a kind of basic research, like Isa Genskin's paintings from the mid-1980s, where she laid canvas on her studio floor and rubbed it all over with oil crayon, their imprints like aerial views of a lunar landscape. Niepce and Daguerre's early photographs were also a kind of basic research, starting at the most obvious point, the view, from the inside, looking out, a locating of a self within a place and another kind of anchoring, providing evidence of how it really is at the point where it emerges. Ideally, I'd find a photograph from the mid-1800s that shows the view from my window, but I haven't found it yet. And anyway, the building itself wasn't built until 1870. I did find the original building plans, though, in the Bauaktenkammer, or the Chamber for Construction Records, as well as plans of earlier buildings built on this same triangular plot of land on the banks of Berlin's Landwehr Canal. Evidence that this place existed then, drawn out in brown ink on linen-backed paper, preserved in orderly Prussian archives. The building that was built, in which I now live with my two teenage boys and our two cats, is typical of Berlin's Gründer Zeit, or the founding years. From 1871 onwards, in a newly unified Germany, the population doubled year on year as industry expanded and waves of citizens moved to the city in search of work. Apartment buildings like this were built all over, four floors high, with a series of windows spread out across the front facade and a side wing leading to a back courtyard. My house was built by a Herr Zimmermann, who in the earliest documents in the Bauaktenkammer is described as master baker to the royal court. By the time he submitted the plans for my expansive apartment building 20 years later, his occupation is Holzhändler, a dealer in lumber. During this period of rampant construction, wood was more lucrative than bread, for sure. You can see it in the paintings and sketches by Adolf Menten, bricklayers working on wooden scaffolds, backyards with wooden fences and fluttering lines of laundry. There may not be much photographic evidence of this time, but Menzel's early realist works are vivid visual documents. As well as grandiose portraits of King William I and scenes of his court, there are countless incidental pieces that depict a city in the making and how it is inhabited. Laundry washing, iron rolling, train travel, beds, bicycles, musical instruments, the countryside beyond the city's walls. One of Menzel's paintings shows a nighttime view over the recently built Anhalter Bahnhof, one of Berlin's main train stations, where locomotives left for Frankfurt, Munich, Prague, and Vienna. For a short period in the mid-1840s, Menzel lived in a house overlooking the Anhalter Bahnhof. This painting shows the moonlit view from his own back window. I can see the Anhalter Bahnhof from my window too. It's part of my view, although all that remains of it now is a single section of its brickwork portico, barely 20 meters across, with four empty roundels where windows used to be. If the house Menzel lived in 1848 hadn't also been bombed a century later, I would see that from my window as well. But the house is gone. The statuesque train station behind it is gone. Gone too, now, are 9,600 Berlin residents who gathered on the platform of Anhalter Bahnhof between 1941 and 1945, amidst the regular early morning commuter traffic. Jewish Berliners loaded into ordinary passenger cars and transported to Theresienstadt. The view from my window is marked by disappearance, in a city marked by disappearance. In all cities, things are lost as times and needs and people change. But in Berlin, the changes were violent, extreme, and politically motivated. By the end of World War II, half of its pre-war population had been killed, imprisoned, or had fled. Its city centre was nothing but wreckage and rubble, and almost all of its trees had succumbed either to fires or else the dire need for firewood. Even before the disaster that began with the Nazis' power grab in 1933, Berlin's history is full of loss. Since the 12th century, war, famine, disease, and political takeover repeatedly decimated its population and architecture. Later, in the immediate post-war years, thoroughfares became cul-de-sacs and families were split apart as an arbitrary line was drawn through its map by the opposing forces of the Cold War. A zigzag track of fate marks the history of Berlin, used as a political pawn for opposing ideologies, each one leaving a new scar on its built-up surface. When the wall fell suddenly in October 1989, what remained was a patchwork topography of intermittent wastelands and forgotten pockets of space that seemed to plot out literally the potential of a city still unfinished, undefined, open to change and open to anyone. When I moved there from New York City in 2001, no one knew what it would become. And now, post-war wastelands were offered up with no resistance to fill the coffers of a bankrupt city, parcels of land sold off hastily to the highest bidder with no concern as to how the city might look or feel or act once the cranes evacuate the skyline and leave behind them static rows of opportunistic architecture, cheap and unremarkable, amongst which we're supposed to live. It's no wonder, really, that things disappear in a city built on sand, on Märkisches sand, as it's known in the region, a soft and porous medium that absorbs a good part of the energy that crosses its surface. New York City is built on solid bedrock, hard, certain ground from which its skyscrapers shoot up, across which the waters of the Hudson and East River rush, and on which its millions of inhabitants hurry through their urgent daily transactions. Berlin's sandy floor, however, this soft and porous medium, exerts a constant, subtle, downward pull. Does this explain the strange lethargy that sometimes hangs across the city, its shared sense of inertia? I've often felt a certain lack of momentum here, and I'm not alone in this. The feeling that a portion of one's energy simply sinks down and disappears beneath the city's foundation into that porous, accommodating sand. Is it accumulating somewhere in great hidden wells beneath the city's surface? Berlin was not named after the bear it later adopted as its mascot, but after the Slavic name for swamp, Brlur. This etymology is a twofold source of shame. Firstly, the admission of the city's Slavic roots, when all things east were considered uncivilized and the dynastic claims of the Hohenzollern monarchs were emphasized instead. The swamp, meanwhile, both geographically and metaphorically, is bad news. Stinking and heavy, a swamp conceals filth. To the upright Prussian mentality, obsessively concerned with the hygienic removal of bodily fluids, the swamp is the worst possible state. Swamps, floods, morasses, mire, slime, and pulp were all anxiety-producing substances that cast fear into Prussians' erect soldierly morals. The swamp's attribute of leaving no traces of activity, of closing up again after every action, invited the presence of hidden things, things from secret realms and from the domain of the dead. Someone was already lying in every morass or swamp you sank into. So wrote Klaus Tschuerlein in his treatise entitled Male Fantasies, and linked this fear of fluids to the dread and revulsion felt towards women by the German Freikorps, anti-communist paramilitary militias in the years between the wars. A proclivity to revulsion that fed the aggressive racism and authoritarianism led to the rise of fascism in Germany. Harsh punishments were meted out if any of the wet substances in question turned up other than in its specifically designated place or situation, writes Tschuerlein, detailing the Prussian compulsion for mopping up. A dangerous breeding ground of sexual repression and deep-rooted but well-concealed anxieties. Berlin's swampy origins, the veil of mist over the wet lowlands, is a fundamental but invisible aspect of the city. You cannot see it, so you don't often think about it. But sometimes you catch a whiff of subterranean swamp on the air, smells that hint at the presence of hidden things from secret realms. Sometimes a disturbing kind of smell like this appears in my bathroom at home, a musty smell like rotten pumpkins. There's something shameful about it, though its exact point of emanation is difficult to determine, as if something that should have been discreetly removed, mopped up, is returning unbidden and rising up from somewhere else. It's ironic, I always think, when accosted by these vile odours, that the basic plan of Berlin's streets and buildings, devised in 1862, was drawn up by an engineer turned urban planner with a passion for and specialization in sewage disposal. James Hobrecht, an efficient Prussian bureaucrat with little feeling for architecture, landscape, or much aesthetic sensibility. The city's first ever pump house for extracting drain water, designed by this very expert, lies directly across the canal from my house. A Wilhelmine era red brick construction. Its red brick chimney rises straight up into the air like a valiant totem for the correct disposal of unwanted fluids and forms the center point in the view from my window. Incredibly, it survived the Allied bombing, tower and all, the only intact pre-war building I can see. Berlin has always had problems with its water table. Occasionally, things that were supposed to disappear rise to the surface again and overflow into visibility, like the body of the communist activist Rosa Luxemburg, murdered exactly 100 years ago next Tuesday by members of the Freikorps. Her body, thrown into the Landwehr Canal, reappeared 5 months later, floating downstream. Most things, however, sink without a trace. Does the swamp's capacity for swallowing evidence and closing up again after every action also have a role to play in Berlin's strangely amnesiac relation to its past? A self-imposed silence, particularly when it came to the all-out destruction of this German city. This scandalous deficiency has become clearer to me over the years, wrote German writer W.G. Sebald, born in 1944. It reminded me that I had grown up with the feeling that something was being kept from me at home, at school, and by the German writers whose books I read, hoping to glean more information about the monstrous events in the background of my own life. Reading this, I think of recent paintings by Amelie von Wulfen of silent families sitting around dinner tables in rustic wood-paneled interiors of almost unbearable oppression. Us British have our own style of repression, buttoned up and stiff upper lipped, but in this particular German brand of silence, Schweigen is the German word for it, silence becomes an action, a collective willed suppression. The exhibition of these paintings by Amelie von Wulfen in Barbara Weiss's Berlin Gallery in 2016 was titled Der Tote im Sumpf, The Dead Man in the Swamp. Von Wulfen belongs to a generation known in Germany as Kriegsenkel, or grandchildren of the war. In the last 10 years or so, following half a century of Schweigen, waves of literature and art have begun to emerge in which the grandchildren begin to pick at the wounds of generations before them and articulate the trauma that their parents and their parents' parents had so actively suppressed. Those born between 1939 and 1945, who were babies or small children during the bombings, fires, evacuations, and death of the war years, are said to have been the most severely traumatized, but were, of course, the least equipped to come to terms with their experiences, their entire mechanism tripwired for survival. It is a thorny task to try and disentangle Berliners' war experience from their Nazi culpability, but how do you place the children of Berlin who suffered in the war? These children grew to become a rigidly silent social body, self-adjusted for bare survival, and better able to deal with catastrophe than with the possible joys that life might bring. When I'm standing at my kitchen window, I try and envisage the view as it was in April 1945, when in the wreckage of the city, German soldiers fought the war's last futile battles in the streets around Anhalter Bahnhof. Troops made up at this late stage of teenage boys in ill-fitting uniforms, their helmets slipping over their eyes, untrained and terrified. In an online trawl for evidence of this particular past, my attention snags on an eyewitness account. Witness Frau A. lived on Tempelhofer Ufer. This is the street that I live on. From there, she saw corpses floating in the Landwehr Canal. There were at least 1,000 altogether. All that is gone now. Nothing floats in the canal except some ducks or swans at most. The water's surface is unbearably still. Visible traces of all that came before have disappeared, uncannily so. When the war was finally over, as Sebald writes, the quasi-natural reflex, engendered by feelings of shame and a wish to divide the victors, was to keep quiet and look the other way. Is this the reason why the view from my window became so insistent, and why the house began to cry? So that rather than keep quiet and look the other way, I would look straight on and interrogate those streets and buildings, to bear witness, even if only in retrospect. I moved to the canal as a way to find a current, and maybe this is it. Thank you.
Hi, I'm going to just read 5 poems, and I'm going, that was amazing, Kirsty. I like you, we were talking about this earlier, the idea of where the energy goes. What's up? Are you all right? Do people need to fit in here? What's going on out there? I'm just going to read 5 poems. I'm going to tell you about these poems, about how I wrote them up.
Do you mind if I set some things down? This here with you.
So, I'm going to read these poems that are from a ritual that I've been working on for a couple of years now. So, I work on rituals, meaning that I'm not going to talk about why I started writing this. I'm not interested in doing that, but the original reason was always to write poems differently and to not be in the space that I was in. That's why I created these. Let's just leave it at that. But since then, I've discovered that I can use these rituals to do all manner of things. For instance, I had a very severe depression after I had a boyfriend who I met in the 80s during ACT UP demonstrations, and he wanted things tortured and raped and murdered, and I was very depressed. So I used this one ritual to get out of that, and it was successful. But the ritual that I've been working on the last couple of years is called Resurrect Extinct Vibration, where I'm thinking about the fact that now that I'm in my, especially, you know, I'm in my 50s, and I'm thinking about when I was a child in 1966, when there were, well, very few people compared to what we have now, but also there were many more creatures on the planet. We've lost about 60% of the wild creatures on the planet in my lifetime. And that number is accelerating this year, the things we've been looking at. So what I've been doing is thinking about how when my infant cells were proliferating, they were doing so on a more wild organic vibration than what we have now. Children being born today are being born on a more mechanized vibration. I think we need to start thinking about the generation gap and a very different kind of conversation we need to be having about self-growth and thinking about how children are not going to be absorbing the world the way people my age were doing when we were born. So that's something I've been doing. What I've been doing is I've been collecting, I'm thinking about eco-poetics as a conversation about vibrational absence, auditory absence, that when a creature leaves the planet, they take all of their sounds with them, their heartbeat, their footfalls, everything. So what I do is when I'm driving around the United States, I'm trying to do this in all 50 states, and I've just got a grant that I'm very excited about, so I'm going to be able to continue doing it this year and get to Alaska in particular to do this. I lie on the ground and I put very small speakers near my body, and I flood my body with these sounds of these extinct animals. And there are other ingredients, and the first 2 poems I'm going to be reading are from a new ingredient. In fact, the first poem I'm going to read, I just finished yesterday morning, and I think it's ready. That's bold, saying that. I never read something today, but I feel that this is all right. So with this latest ingredient was, I wanted to do a ritual that went into my birthday, which is January 1st. So what I did was I started the new moon of December 7th and went to new moon January 6th. And what I did was, I'm a huge fan of Louise Nevelson's sculpture. And I like to look at Louise Nevelson as a problem solver. I have artist friends who get really annoyed when I say this, but that's too bad. I look at Louise Nevelson as sort of like a place, like an equation, where what information is at the whole structure, especially these pieces where they're large boxes with interior smaller boxes. I look at her, I like to approach her work as though the bigger box is the is the question, and these smaller boxes have the clues. So I started using her work as like a mechanism to put my information and my questions. I planted a tiny little crystal outside the wall where her piece is on display in Denmark at the Louisiana Museum. And then another one outside of the Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Arts in Philadelphia, where there's a marvelous piece there, by the way, if you forget to see it, called Perpendiculars 1. And this piece was constructed from the remains of the St. Mark's Church organ after there was a fire in the 70s. So I wanted to use that in particular because, of course, she spent more than half a century in this neighborhood. Anyway, so I felt auspicious to be using this particular piece. So then I planted a crystal outside of the Nelson Atkins, no relation to her, I don't believe, a museum in Kansas City, Missouri, where one of my favorite pieces is at right now. So, and then what I do is, so this creates a triangle that stretches across the United States and across the ocean. And then I would sit inside that triangle to write, and there was a lot more going, but I don't really want to get into everything else. So where this is going this year is, this year is the end. This is going to be the end of this bigger ritual. And it's going to wind up being that I'm thinking about the decay and being part of that decay. I'm going to call it Faggots Afraid of Wrinkles, because most of my friends in the 80s and 90s are dead. I mean, almost all of them. And those of us left behind are very traumatized, and nobody wants to talk to us about it, so we just like talk to one another about it. And that's not always very helpful. But I want to, you know, I mean, I was recently, not that long ago, actually at this friend's house, who's constantly saying, you need, we're aging, you need to do these things with your wrinkles. I was like, fuck you, Jeffrey. You know, and while I was sleeping, he thought I was asleep, and he started smearing this stuff on my face. And I just let him, you know, I just thought, whatever. And didn't do anything anyway. It would make me feel greasy. So I'm trying to track that, and also to try to love this world differently. I mean, we can't bring back these creatures. We're doing a lot of amazing things right now to stave off this hemorrhaging, but we're not going to get back those things that are gone. So it's sort of like this point where we need to have a little bit of closure with what's gone in my lifetime. So that's where I hope to be at the end of this year. So I'm going to read these first two are from the Nevelson Crystal Grid. And this one is called, oh, and I just had this conversation, so you see how it's shaped. And I'm not here to gossip, but anyway, this magazine editor said, why do you care about where I put the title and your name? And I said, well, you know how some architects, they will design the dining room and the silverware and all that. I said, so the title and my poems are my silverware. So I want them there if you're going to eat in that house. He's like, oh, well, that makes sense. I said, wow, that worked. That's amazing. So this one is titled, You Cannot Return a Stretched Mind. Human life expectancy is rising. I ask which group they mean. No one knows the answer. My favorite lovers were men who knew they were dying. They taught me to race to my limits without hesitation. Sometimes it takes more death than I can endure to caress life. If you could have seen my face the moment I realized no help was coming, despite every dream of lovers around the globe uniting, grateful for our embrace to hold the sadness different. We are too fragile for the world we are making, pretending to be tough. A sudden fear of heights over the Atlantic. Our bodies remember all of this survived. Old answers fail to accept our family as every neighbor. My aunt says the prison means good paying jobs for generations. I imagine prison guards not yet born having lunch and fed their parents. I plead with her. She laughs the eternal. This one is called Golden in the Morning, Crane Our Necks. And that arrow at the top is part of the title, which is going to annoy somebody, I think, if I send it out. In a past life, I was a little fish who cleaned the shells of turtles. A dream helped me remember their deep voice of thanks. Many nights I heard sharks waiting for the tide to draw me near. When the calendar runs out, it feels lucky another awaits. All I have ever wanted was to forge the English language into a spear and drive it into my heart. Between leaping and being shoved, no lonelier place to put my faith for the swinging motion inside the dance we share. Don the extraordinary suit for this ordinary day. Take our time studying trees to imagine the nests we would build if we were birds. I ask all you talented people spending many creative hours perfecting killer drones, guns, and bombs to please know we are waiting for you on the other side of art in the no-kill zone. So this is the title of the exhibit. I'm very honored and grateful for that. It's called Auguries Cast Aside. To enter the sky with our bodies, the principal concern for inventing airplanes. No one taught me this, any more than they taught me to say good morning to my hippocampus, but I do because I love my hippocampus. I was in a band one summer. We never could harmonize. We smiled and kept playing. We loved our united disunity, a blind, stubborn focus chewing its way out. How awkward the archer after shooting his arrow, remembering first time getting into bed just for sex. They say I'm old now. Ask my advice. All I have to offer is make as many mistakes as you can handle, but make them as soon as possible. Don't waste time following each other from opposite sides of a river. When storm blows wig off my head, it simply means it's time to let the storm take its share. Let's see. Okay. So this is one of the other newer ones, not from the Nevelson, though, just prior to starting that. And it's called Altered After Too Many Years Under the Mask. I feel you judging me for becoming agoraphobic in someone else's house. I forget how I learned to stroll through grocery stores as though there is no crisis. My elbow cannot touch the middle of my back. My fingers, though, have found every part of me. Soon, no migration of wild animals will be unknown to humans. We will chart, film, record, publish, archive everything. It gives us something to do while we annihilate beauty. Poets shoveling a quarry. That is really an ongoing crime scene investigation. A study in vomit, imitating vast chronicles of the face. Whatever world we can hold, we will never agree our neglect was worth it. Whatever amount of crazy we can imagine coming at us, double it. I found the perfect listening chair, but listeners who sit, I am sitting in it now, nobody's there but listeners. Listening to my friend, the photographer, whose self-portrait I find reflected in eyes of her every photo. I have one more to read. So this one is part of the extinct animal ritual, but I do have to tell you, I started writing it when McSweeney's magazine commissioned me to write an article about the upcoming election last year, knowing that I would focus on these 300 anti-lesbian, gay, transgender laws that we were facing that nobody was talking about, by the way, because we mean so little. And I was so fucking angry reading these laws. But I had to be nice in the article because I wanted people to actually read them to know where all these laws were coming at. Now it's hard because I'm not interested in being nice to fascists and talking nice and making people spoon-feed them sugary. But it worked, and people were like responding. So I was like, well, that's nice. But then I wrote this because I was just like, you gotta, like, where does the energy go, as Kirstie says, right? Here's where it went for me. This is called Glitter in My Wounds. And thank you again, everybody. First and most important, dream our missing friends forward. Burn their reflections into empty chairs. We are less bound by time than the clockmaker fears. This morning, all I want is to follow where the stone angels point. Birdsong lashing me to tears. Heterosexuals need to see our suffering, the violent deaths of our friends and lovers. To know glitter on a queer is not to dazzle, but to unsettle the foundation of this murderous culture. Defiant weeds smashing up through cement. You think Oscar Wilde was funny? Well, darling, I think he was busy distracting straight people so they would not kill him. If you knew how many times I've been told, you're not like my gay best friend who tells me jokes and makes me laugh. No, I sure as fuck am not. I have no room in my life to audition for your pansy mascot. You people can't kill me and think you can kill me again? I met a tree in Amsterdam and stood barefoot beside it for 20 minutes, then left completely restored. Yet another poem not written by a poet. Sometimes we need one muscle to relax so the others follow. My friend Mandy calls after a long shift at the strip club to say, while standing in line for death, I am fanning my hot pussy with your new book. Will you sign it next week, my fearless faggot sister?